couple of thousand goddamn questions, you know? I want to speak to someone in charge. I want to lodge a complaint. You have no right to make people crazy. You think I investigated what the contrite story there is, huh? If this is just nerve gas, how come I know everything in such detail? I never been here before.
Heartland to the pyramidal structures on Mars. You're listening to another spine-tingling edition of Untamed Dimensions with me, your host, Adam Gilrightly, and brought to you, as always, by our sponsors, the International Jewish Banking Conspiracy, undermining the world's economy since 1840. Before we dive headfirst into the murky and mystifying waters that will make up our show today, I wanted to mention a new feature here at Blog Talk Radio, which is a chat room that you can go to and chat your little brains away. If you have any messages or for my guest or myself today, what you got to do, the way to get there to this here chat room is just surf on over to www.blogtalkradio.com/gorightly, and you'll see there on the right side of the page where the player is at, that's where you'll find the chat room. Or if I was Batman, I'd call it a bat room. And then once you get to that point, you can probably figure out the rest. If not, too bad. You're apparently technologically challenged, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. So there you go. Anyway, enough of my blather. Let's introduce our guest today. He is Ty Brown, who is the blogger behind the blog known as The Dream's End and the Duncan Blake Annex. Ty, are you there?
I'm here, and we actually, the address to the new site, and I can talk about why there is even a new site, is dreamsendweb.com, and all the material from those other two sites you mentioned is available there, hopefully even a little better organized.
Okay, very good, and I have that linked up at my blog, which is gorightly.wordpress.com, so people can find it there as well. Ty, so with this whole story of the Teresa Duncan and Jeremy Blake, could you start at the beginning of this strange tale and tell our listeners exactly who they were and how they apparently met their respective demises? Perhaps first give us the official story, then tell us how you first started investigating all of this and exactly where your investigations have led.
Well, I'll do my best now. I just listened to the introduction, and especially a little staticky over the phone. I'm actually a little frightened, but I'm going to do my best to recover from that and outline the story. The woman's name was Teresa Duncan. She was called a filmmaker and writer. The only film, to her credit, that we know anything about was an animated film that was evidently made in 1999 called The History of Glamour. And it is less than 30 minutes. I don't know exactly how long it is. And it was apparently accepted into a exhibition at the Whitney Art Museum, so it was well respected. I can't confirm the dates because I've got a copy of the film and there's no copyright date or anything on it, but that's the timeline I see online. And she made some video games for girls, was her primary target, back in the CD-ROM-based days, where video gaming, think of Myst, only animated and with girl-oriented themes where girls could run around and explore this little town and write in their diary and try on clothes. And I think maybe there's even a little bit of a detective story behind it. I'm not really sure because the bootlegs of those have not surfaced yet. I know they will eventually, but I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. She had a boyfriend, actually a long-term. They lived together, and his name was Jeremy Blake. And he is a visual artist who, by the end of his career, was concentrating very much on sort of video, computer-enhanced, large painting-size displays, but that were animated, some very abstract. And they got a little bit more, not really documentary, but they had a little more narrative to them as he went on. He did some of these. He did for Punch Drunk Love. There's some sort of surreal-looking animated bits that come in and out of Punch Drunk Love, and he was the one who provided those. He did some also for a Beck video, mm-hmm. the singer Beck. So he was actually fairly well known for what he did. They lived at different times in California. Most recently in California, they lived in Venice, which is sort of part of Los Angeles on the coast, and then they also ended up their lives in New York City. And on July 10th of this year, Teresa Duncan, who was really primarily known evidently for her blog in the last couple years because she was a prolific blogger, usually one or two posts a day, she evidently committed suicide by an overdose of Tylenol PM and bourbon. And Jeremy Blake came and found her in their apartment, which they rented from the St. Mark's Episcopal Church. It was their former rectory. And found her apparently dead, or maybe it was clear that she was dead at that point. And a week later, he killed himself, so the story goes, by walking into the ocean. And his body was discovered 4 or 5 days later, and then rather than do a DNA test, they decided to wait until they could figure out who his last dentist had been. And they found a dentist, and so 8 or 9 days later, they got a forensic dentist person to identify his body as being Jeremy Blake. And the body was found in the ocean by some fishermen. The fishermen had never been interviewed. And the police had originally been instructed to look for a body in the first place by a caller. A woman called, said she saw someone walking into the ocean. We don't know who that person is. But that was that. There evidently was supposed to be a toxicology report done on Teresa Duncan, I would guess 3 or 4 weeks ago is when that should have happened. They didn't release it publicly, but probably more importantly, no reporters seemed to be that interested in going after that information. So I don't know what the tox report said. And if there was anything done as far as autopsy on Jeremy Blake's body, other than just identifying it from dental records, I'm not aware of that. I don't know why they would assume necessarily it was suicide. It was kind of strange. He was actually in a train on the way to, he was putting some affairs in order and was getting ready to go to the memorial service for Teresa Duncan up in Michigan, where she was from, and evidently got off a stop or two early and headed out into the ocean. So if they did do some sort of autopsy to determine if foul play was involved, they haven't released that information. Mm-hmm. And that is the mainstream story.
And if they were going to script a movie, that certainly sounds like a dramatic one, the life and times of Teresa Duncan and Jeremy Blake.
It is. It was very, it actually, one of the things that struck my attention, that caught my attention was that it seemed almost a bit too contrived and a bit too literary, the way the whole thing unfolded. But anyway, go ahead, you were going to ask a question.
Yes, walking into the ocean seems, perhaps I shouldn't laugh about that, but, so, tell me, after you took in this official story, or exactly what was the starting point for you in this adventure down a certain rabbit hole?
Well, you know, and I'll plug your book for you, because I'm reading it right now, your biography of Carrie Thornley, and it's interesting how this story spread, because it's very similar. This is not offered as proof. It's offered as an observation. It's very similar, actually, to the way good disinformation is spread. The story did not make the mainstream news first. Teresa Duncan died on July 10th. There was no news of this. Jeremy Blake went missing on July 17th. And again, there was no news of this. They were not major celebrities, but there was no reporting whatsoever. And then around the 19th or so, a perfume blog began openly questioning, well, why is Teresa Duncan no longer posting? And then, you know, just by one of these amazing coincidences with this story, the woman who runs that particular perfume blog, and I guess we should say for your listeners, Duncan, one of the things she wrote about a lot was perfume. She did little reviews of perfumes, very poetically written. The best stuff that she wrote actually was those. I have no idea if they're accurate, because it's like wine tasting. When you hear them talk about the complexity of the wine, and I can't follow them or really taste what they're tasting, but they're very well written. So she had a following in the perfume community that I didn't even know there was such a thing. And this woman happened to have a friend who was a medical examiner in the New York City Medical Examiner's office, who was able to confirm the story. And just by a weird coincidence, he happened to be writing a novel about perfume. So that was kind of odd. And then she also happened to be friends with an ex-girlfriend of Jeremy Blake's, who evidently had been receiving some word about this. And so she was talking to that person as well. I don't know who that woman is. So that's where it started, except for one mention on July 12th by an artist who evidently knew Duncan's mom. Nobody picked it up from that. And then on the 19th, the blog post was put out, and then a couple other blogs picked it up. And then it filtered up into the mainstream media. And eventually there was an article in New York Times in the arts section. There was an article in the LA Weekly, an article in the LA Times, and it just kind of went from there. Newsweek did something about it. So it was sort of interesting the way it filtered into public consciousness. And the way it got into mine is I was a regular visitor of a website called Rigorous Intuition that I'd be surprised if a large number of your listeners were not familiar with. And Jeff Wells had seen it on what's it called, Metafilter, I guess, where just sort of things get put up and discussed. And it turned out that Teresa Duncan linked to his blog several times and actually had written about him, written a couple of things about him and his blog and what she liked about it. And then actually, if you look closer, there were several links to his blog back and forth. So he wrote two or three blog posts about how strange it was that she linked to him, and also noticing that in the last month or so, her blog posts were what the mainstream media was calling paranoid. She thought Scientology was out to get her. And, you know, I have suggested that one definition of living in Los Angeles is living surrounded by Scientologists. That they're a very, very big presence there. That doesn't necessarily mean they were stalking her or anything. Mm-hmm. And she was also concerned about a guy named Jim County, who is a big Republican rich fella who was in Des Moines, Iowa, and started the Des Moines Cable Company there, very right wing, gave $1 million to a local Catholic school, I noticed. I can't get a whole lot of information about him, but I did find that. He has as guardian some people he took over as guardian when they were kids and their parents died. And one of those is an artist named Anna Gaskell. And she is a former girlfriend of Jeremy Blake. And so part of Teresa Duncan's concern was that Jim County was after her, that she had publicly, I guess he knew that she knew some stuff about what he was up to. She had accusations of Project Monarch-like activity, that maybe some, you know, child sexual abuse was involved, and maybe even involving Anna Gaskell and the siblings there. None of it really substantiated, but Jeremy Blake, she said, had all these memories that came rushing back to him that he'd forgotten about these really sort of dark comments that were made that hinted at this sort of thing. And that's right up Jeff Wells' alley. That's the kind of thing he looks into a lot. She wrote about 3 or 4 days before she died, oh, I'm working on a post about that I'm calling The Devil and Dick Cheney. She said it was a political post called The Devil and Dick Cheney, and then 3 days later, evidently, she was dead. So Jeff Wells wrote 3 or 4 posts about that and a lot of the oddities involved. He had some people contact him who provided some additional leads. For example, Anna Gaskell's brother turned out to be the editor in 2005 of a weekly in Des Moines, Iowa called Point Blank, and had done a story about Project Monarch, the abduction of Johnny Gosch, a 12-year-old paperboy back in 1982, that ties into a lot of the conspiracy theory around this. It was done as a straight article. I think it even had an interview with Johnny Gosch's mom, Noreen.
Mm-hmm.
But then when someone queried him about that sometime later, or at least according to an email that's been circulated on the Internet, he said, oh, the thing was an April Fool's joke. Whatever the reality was, that was the last issue of Point Blank, and but he didn't get in trouble for his April Fool's joke. He was actually made editor of the other Des Moines Weekly. Meanwhile, Anna Gaskell's art is very dark, very ominous. It's pictures of 12-year-old girls, a lot of times dressed up as Alice in Wonderland with sort of ominous themes. There's another set of – they're photographs, actually,
mm-hmm.
of based on a fairy tale of a girl who tries to put on an animal skin so she could hide from her molesting father.
Yeah.
So clearly she was playing with those themes, and the fact that Teresa Duncan was interested in Project Monarch and thought maybe it was touching on her life in some way, and that Anna Gaskell's brother was writing about it as a joke, you know, it all ties in, and it's all very interesting, and what's going on here, and that's how I started getting interested in the story.
Now, back to Anna Gaskell for a moment. Have you posted some of her photographs on your blog, or is there a way to check
these out? I've got a couple, but the easiest way is to just do a Google search or pick your engine of choice. Don't mean to push Google. It's become part of the lexicon. And it's Anna Gaskell, G-A-S-K-E-L-L. And if you put that in quotes and you'll flip over to the images search, you'll find a bunch of them. They're real easy to find, and you'll see there's a lot of twins where the two girls will look exactly alike. A lot of times they're dressed up like Alice in Wonderland with a little blue dress on.
The Alice in Wonderland theme is curious, and a lot of these Monarch MKUltra stories, this Alice in Wonderland imagery is often used as part of the whole programming matrix, allegedly, supposedly.
Yeah, they and it's difficult to talk about these things because there's so many details, but I don't discount Project Monarch, but I've seen no evidence that is going to allow me to say that every single thing about that story is true.
Mm-hmm.
So what I can say, though, is that there is a pretty pretty well-known storyline around Project Monarch, and it involves intentional traumatization and even sexual abuse of children with the purpose of instilling some sort of mind control programming so that later on they can be used as either sex slaves or secret missions of various kinds, even assassination missions. And I think a lot of that has actually gotten exaggerated, but I'm not going to say for sure that it's gotten exaggerated. It's very clear that Teresa Duncan was familiar with that material, and she talked about it, and she actually had more images that sort of revolve around that than she even really mentioned, because every one of her blog posts had an image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a picture, usually of a model, a fairly famous model, but posed in, there's some Alice in Wonderland pictures, for example, that show up throughout her blog. Now, that's not an unusual theme, but it is tied into Project Monarch, so
yeah.
it's something you want to pay attention to.
So, continue on.
Well, okay, so the story actually, evidently, as I look back on it, didn't really begin for me at that point, actually. It began earlier in two different ways. One of them, which I think I'll only mention pretty briefly because I'm not exactly sure if it ties in, only that a woman several months ago started emailing me under a bunch of different names Sometimes she'd admit to being the other people, sometimes she wouldn't. Sometimes the writing was lucid, sometimes it was very childish, sometimes it was almost impenetrably dense and I couldn't understand what she was talking about. She was tied in to the Whitley Strieber discussion boards. I'd written a series of articles about Whitley Strieber, and she was writing me and complaining about particular posts over there, and I don't follow that board, so I really didn't know what she was talking about most of the time. Eventually, she wrote me some information about her past, which sounded pretty credible, but then she turned on me, decided I was part of a conspiracy against her, and got really angry and said, oh, I'd be glad when they found her dead body and this sort of thing. Evidently, Jeff Wells was receiving similar emails from this woman, and then he got one from someone claiming to be friends of this person with her phone number saying, oh, would you please call her? And because she's at the end of a rope, we don't know what to do, and she seems to have some faith in you or whatever. He didn't call, but he forwarded the email to me and said, have you gotten an email from this woman, and what do you think of this? And so this was by private message on his discussion forum. And the reason I say that ties in is because one of the people who's been contacting me, I realized fairly recently, and sending me down what seemed to be fairly unrelated pathways, but trying to connect them into this anyway. It turns out to be that same person under yet another name. The reason I brought it up is because all those private messages I had going back and forth with Jeff Wells disappeared from his discussion board, and he wasn't really that concerned about it. And when I brought it up, and my whole theories that I later developed about the Teresa Duncan thing were not very well received over there. And part of what happened there was those private messages disappeared. The other thing that happened was, given the research I was doing on my blog before, which had to do with sort of intelligence manipulation of sort of New Age spirituality and all that sort of thing that you can read about on the blog, and I got contacted by some people who were working together doing research, and they had a private forum. It was members only, even to be read, and they said, oh, you might be interested in what we're doing. Why don't you come take a look? And this was probably a couple weeks before the Duncan thing broke. And I got involved with them around other issues. They were looking into stuff around Ira Einhorn, also looking into stuff around the aviary, particular. I guess they'd gotten their start trying to expose who was behind the Serpo material, which is, I'm not even that familiar with it, but one of those seems to me fairly obvious pieces of disinformation about an alien-human exchange program, and it seems that Richard Doty, who's former Air Force Special Investigation, former Air Force Intelligence, was behind this story, as he seems to be behind so many of those stories, and they were trying to out him as being behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were interacting actually with another CIA fellow named Kit Green, who is also part of the aviary. And whatever descriptive value that term even has now,
right.
And he was evidently real good friends with Richard Doty and was involved in the Serpo stuff, and so they were communicating with him. And actually, the woman who'd invited me originally to go to this forum was planning on meeting him regularly for lunch. I think she planned one or two meetings with him. A little odd. She's in Washington and he's in Michigan. And the reason I say that's related is Kit Green happens to be a professor at Wayne State University. He is into neurophysiology. And who else is at Wayne State University is Teresa Duncan's mother. And oddly enough, despite getting a Ph.D. in political science and being very interested in fairly left-wing causes, she did some paper. She wrote her thesis on art within the Black Panther movement. She took the next logical career step and came to be the person in charge of making sure that Wayne State is in compliance with standards for human experimentation. Very, very odd. You know? So I was already sort of interacting indirectly with one person at Wayne State, and then the Duncan thing came along, and it turns out her mother, who's never been interviewed or never even issued a statement as far as I know, is also working at Wayne State, and I really began to wonder what on earth is going on. That's how I got into it.
Kit Green's a pretty famous name in intelligence agency lore and being involved. I think some termed him back in the day as a sort of equivalent to Mulder with the X-Files, and Kit Green had been involved with a lot of the folks on the cutting edge of paranormal research years ago, like Andrea Puharik and Uri Geller and that group, as well as Ira Einhorn. So that is a name that's pretty well known in these areas, and of course a lot of conspiracy type theories swirl around him.
Well, you can read about him involved in the remote viewing program. He went in that Jim Schnabel book, America's Psychic Spies. He was remote viewing America's Psychic Spies. I'm not getting the title quite right.
Mm-hmm.
But the pseudonym I think used was Kennett, but I think it was pretty well demonstrated that was Kit Green. He's around and accessible. I haven't talked to him. I feel like I'm not, I'm probably worried about how easy I am to manipulate, so I try. I haven't approached him, and I just sort of started putting together how closely connected, but also to the research I was doing. I was interested in the remote viewing program. He was involved in the remote viewing program. I'm interested in the Nine and Andrea Puharic, and he was in those circles. Actually, it's one circle, really. It's not like he's hopping around to a bunch of different those.
Yeah.
But one of the commonalities that really seems to feature in that is their involvement with Scientology. And allegedly using techniques from Scientology, and of course the prominent remote viewers were Scientologists, the researchers behind remote viewing were Scientologists, and the reason that tied into my research also was I was looking into a book called The Changing Images of Man, which was actually, I don't think it was published publicly until 1982, but I guess it was a decade before that when they actually did the study. And it was commissioned by what used to be called the Stanford Research Institute, SRI. That's where the remote viewing stuff was also done. And the idea was to look into the future, project what the future was going to be like, and then figure out what spirituality should we in the West have that would most make it most likely for us to have a positive future. Now, keep in mind, SRI is a defense contractor primarily. So their version of what would make a good future may not match with ours. But in any event, it turned out later, they didn't mention it in the book, but it turned out later that the way they came up with their scenarios, they had 50 different likely possible future scenarios that they were based on, and only four of them, they said, had a positive sort of feel to them. But the way they came up with those future scenarios is actually using Scientology remote viewing kind of techniques to sort of remote view the future. It wasn't based on, that and reading sci-fi. And I swear to you, those are the two methods they used to decide what the future was going to be like, and then from there to extrapolate what religion we should all have. And so they outlined that religion, and they said, well, happily, this seems to be developing anyway, but here's what we think people should believe. And we should do everything we can to encourage these beliefs. And a lot of it would be fairly familiar to people familiar with both Scientology, but also sort of general New Age spirituality. I'm not saying that all of it on its face is harmful. I'm just very distrustful when, military-industrial complexes is pushing a particular spiritual perspective. So, so I wondered what was going on there.
What better way to manipulate a mass, amount of people through religion, obviously. So
yeah, obviously. And I wrote about that, and people, it's a long story, and I've probably got more parts to do, but there's a whole series about that on my blog as well. So Kit Green comes in, and he's sort of in the middle of all of that. Ira Einhorn, they were talking about at this place, this research forum, and I was interested in him for the same reason. He was sort of a one-man internet, and then when the very early internet showed up, he was an early adapter, but he was funded by Bell Telephone. They were interested in having him distribute his sort of cutting-edge, new paradigm stuff all over the place. So what exactly that was, I don't know, but we do know that Ira Einhorn ended up in jail for allegedly killing his girlfriend, and so I was interested in all of that, and there it was all in front of me. And what else was in front of me was a long thread by there were only two people who seemed to actually post on this forum. One of them called in yesterday to, I did a show with Miles Lewis on Anomaly Radio, and the guy went by KT, on this forum. I don't know his real name. He called in, but he seemed to be sort of an expert in alternate reality games, and he was particularly interested in how the people, the media theorists and the really cutting-edge Internet folks who were able to create alternate reality games also seemed, that community seemed to overlap a lot with certain types of occultists and also certain political philosophies and also within the intelligence community, not saying that anyone in any one of those groups was in all of those groups, just that there was an overlap there he was interested in, and that alternate reality games could be used for purposes of things like disinformation or actually shaping public opinion and public perception in a way that can sort of be tossed off as, oh, it's just a game, it's just fiction. And by the way, alternate reality games can be creative and wonderful fun. I'm not condemning them in general, but they do blur the line between reality and fiction, and some of the most famous games do that within conspiracy subculture. They even play out or provide clues on for some of their games on websites and discussion boards that ostensibly are doing real research and engaged in real discussion. Above Top Secret, for example, was utilized to put out information for the alternate reality game called Majestic. So he was interested in all of that. So I started looking at this Duncan stuff, and the more I looked at it, the more it read as false to me, as if the blog was not just stream of consciousness every day, but had been constructed to draw attention to certain ideas, to certain other websites, to certain clues about what was really going on underneath the surface. And I started looking at it that way, and people didn't like it very much, but that's what I started doing.
So I guess you started to suspect certain things about this whole story, like you mentioned, that it seemed to have been constructed for some specific reason, and along the way you became suspicious if the deaths of Teresa Duncan and Jeremy Blake had actually happened, if it was some, or in fact it was something that had been created as possibly part of some alternate reality game.
Yeah, I tell you, the people who create alternate reality games, one thing that's difficult is that Internet people can be cynical and are very savvy and can get very cynical about things like viral marketing very quickly. And so, oh, it's just another alternate reality game, quickly becomes the thing you worry about. So if you want to make a big splash, do something big, you've got to come up with the next generation. And I think that a goal for some of these folks would be to make it really big, let's blur the line from between reality and fiction in a way that is just absolutely mind-blowing. So I thought maybe that was part of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, it was clear from one of the first things I noticed, it was clear from Duncan's, this wasn't the first thing I noticed, but I came to notice, she was very familiar with a history of artistic hoaxing. She referred to it on her blog several different times, sometimes obliquely, sometimes directly. For example, she referred and in a positive light talked about J.T. Leroy, an author who was a young man who, I guess, transsexual, became a female as a teenager, had a very difficult life, wrote about that life in novels, made some public appearances, and it turns out did not in fact exist and was a creation of another person who had gotten an actress to play him in public. She was familiar with that. Mm-hmm. She promoted another story about Pete Doherty, the magician, the musician, that the allegation was that he was actually a nobody and had just been promoted as a hoax. Then it turned out that itself was a hoax, that he is actually a very fine musician, and that was just put out as another hoax. She put stuff like that on her blog fairly regularly. There's a whole artistic sort of and political and philosophical tradition called situationism, which gave rise to something mm-hmm. called neoism, which is sort of a tongue-in-cheek philosophy, but the aesthetic behind it is hoaxing. And I want to give you one quick example. Back in the, I guess, late 80s, this would have been later, I'm blanking on the year, but anyway, there was an artist named Darko Malvoy, who was known for very, very just grotesque images of body parts and people who've been killed in violent ways. And he was in Serbia, and the Serbian authorities were not reacting well to his artwork. He eventually ended up in jail. A law was passed specifically to outlaw his work, and then he was eventually evidently assassinated. There were pictures that were circulated. There was a whole movement of showing his work posthumously, and sort of a movement that grew up before he was killed to try and free him, and he never existed. And so the people behind it came out and said, "Oh, we did it!" And they even showed pictures of the guy. You know, there's a picture of him after he'd been shot, and then there's another picture of him sitting up with a can of ketchup or whatever it is. Now, the reason I bring this up is that the way they announced their hoax, and this is a group, I can't tell you exactly what their name is because it's a binary number and it's a long one. It's like 01101101. That's what they call themselves. Mm-hmm. They have another famous hoax where they created basically a mirror site of the Vatican, and you could barely tell it was not the Vatican, only there were a few little sort of funny things they put in there to sort of make it clear that it wasn't the site, but it had almost the exact same web address. Anyway, this kind of thing, it was clear to me that Duncan was familiar with that sort of thing, and there were others, and I won't get into all the examples, but there were other connections that she wrote about that said to me that she was very familiar with this idea of artistic hoaxing, even in terms of death hoaxes, and that maybe that's what was going on here. And then I started to look at her blog as one sort of uniform whole piece of literature. And if you do it that way, you start to see interesting bits of foreshadowing and that sort of thing that really make it look like she knew 2 years ago that she was going to disappear. Now, to be honest, I tried to do a little bit of on-the-ground research. I only had to do it by telephone. I did call the police in New York. I called the police in New Jersey. Nobody said to me, "What are you talking about? She didn't die." Everyone has said, yes, you know, they didn't give me a whole lot of insider details, but they didn't change the story. So I did do that, and I posted about that on the blog as well. So how to explain my theory? Well, I'm either wrong, or those folks are in on it, or, you know, there's some bodies were switched. I doubt that's the case. So I'm not, you know, we will see. I mean, what will happen will happen. But that was kind of what got me thinking in that direction.
Spell out your working theory at this point.
I still, against the world, I think, I think that Teresa Duncan herself did not exist. I think there was a person named Teresa Duncan, but like all of us, like you and like me, you can't judge who we are from the blog. And that blog has been substituted for Teresa Duncan. I think the blog may have even been collectively written. It certainly changed after death twice. Once it was done openly, a guy named Glenn O'Brien, who writes for a fashion magazine, I've forgotten which one at the moment, he's got connections all the way back to the Andy Warhol factory crowd. Which itself is something that Teresa Duncan was fascinated with. For some reason, early 70s, she was seemed to write about extensively, both in terms of occult, underground film, music. She was really into that era.
Mm-hmm.
So they created this Teresa Duncan with this blog, and then they removed her from the scene at just the right point dramatically, and the two of them possibly, according to my theory, could still be alive and have done this as a hoax, have done this just sold out and introduced a huge new alternate reality game that's coming, have done this because they had some really important political message to put out there that they did not think could get out any other way. That's sort of an interesting possibility in the sense that it looks like there's a larger picture being painted here and our attention is being drawn, not just by discussion of Scientology, but also the whole idea about child exploitation and child trafficking. She's got a lot of posts on her blog that look like little innocent posts that talk about this and that, but all of these sort of mentions of older actors exploiting girls or young actresses. She was, for example, interested in Tuesday Weld, who seems to have a background. You know a lot. I think you know some about that.
Yeah.
You might even chime in there. But she mentioned Tuesday Weld a couple of times. And Tuesday Weld started out as a child model. And I think, given what I've read, I think it's fair to say that she was probably exploited sexually when she was quite young. And then figures in some conspiracy theory stuff that you had run into. And the only reason I brought that up is because it seemed like maybe Teresa Duncan was familiar with it. She didn't mention it. You know, you had found someone who believed Tuesday Weld was a high priestess in an Illuminati or satanic cult sort of situation. But she did mention Tuesday Weld, and then I had a reporter, Kate Coe, over at LA Weekly, who emailed me when I asked her why she was even writing me, because she should think I'm a lunatic. She did the first major story about how they died, and her take was they were paranoid, they alienated their friends, and then Teresa Duncan killed herself, and then a week later, Jeremy Blake did. But she said, you know what? She died on a Tuesday. Her dog's name was Tuesday. Jeremy died on a Tuesday, and she was really into Tuesday Weld. And that was sort of an odd comment coming from a journalist, but I started looking at it, and I thought, oh, so what am I supposed to know about Tuesday Weld? And that's actually how I came across your article that I ended up
yeah.
linking to.
Interesting.
And I get so many of these little things where I'm given a
yeah.
tip here or there, and it ties in with things, and yet it's so difficult to succinctly put out there that most people think I'm insane.
And you mentioned... still talking about the Tuesday Weld connection. Somebody put out a magazine or a zine of sorts, and
I don't know that anyone put it out. What I do know is that this whole thing is like a big black box to me, meaning I don't know what the heck's going on, so all I can do is poke it and prod it. I'm not allowed to open it, evidently, so I poke it and prod it and listen and see what happens. So one of the ways I poked and prodded is I'd make a few predictions. One of the predictions was there will be some clue sites that will open up if that's what
mm-hmm.
this is about. There have to be some sites to point us in the direction because it's too subtle. I'm the only person in the universe, and evidently I'm not doing a good job of convincing anybody. So there was a site like that opened. It's called the Duncan Blake Rumor Mill.
Mm.
And so it just started putting out these clues. We don't know who the person is behind it. He calls him or herself Theremy, combining Teresa and Jeremy into the one Theremy. And one of the clues he put out was, oh, well, there were a couple of different fanzines that seemed to be put out. He didn't really give a timeline. And both of them had on the cover Tuesday Weld with some very other provocative images on there. One of the images was the SLA, the Simeonese Liberation Army logo, the seven-headed Hydra or whatever that is. And Teresa Duncan's mom, according to Teresa Duncan's blog, was very familiar with COINTELPRO tactics against Gene Seberg, who was associated with the Black Panthers. And so it just sort of made it look like that there was a connection between Tuesday Weld and the SLA being made, but without it being explicit at all. I want to make it clear. I'm not real clear exactly what they're trying to say, but those images
yeah.
were on there. And even some code was provided on this site, and he just put it like an alphanumeric code, and he didn't explain what it was. And I actually asked, I said, what is that? He said, I don't know, it's just a code. It was in the magazine. So
it's,
I don't know, but that's the kind of thing that came out. And nothing. He didn't release any scans of it. Nobody has released any scans of it. No one else has confirmed this magazine. These two magazines existed, but that's what was put out.
It's curious, you know, these references to Tuesday Weld and the Illuminati or perhaps MK Ultra connections really came into popular culture not that long ago. A couple of years ago, I'd written an article about this, and you wonder, perhaps I've been used as a useful idiot in this regard.
I was wondering whose fault it was, so I'm glad I squared that away. No, we've all been used that way, but I'm not even sure "used" is the right word because
uh-huh.
there's such a mixture. You are more familiar than I am with the sort of background of Discordianism, and there's a lot of hoaxers out there who love to mix up this tradition of what's real and what's not, and I think that from a Discordian perspective, maybe it's not even that important what's true and what's not. something weird happened around 9/11, but if we can throw some Illuminati stuff in there that may have no connection whatsoever, why not? Let's stir up the pot.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a side of this that feels like that, but underneath, it could be about calling attention to some real issues. It could also be about discrediting people who are looking into real issues. I really am not sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the kind of thing that's going on.
Well, yeah, you were talking about the whole monarch thing before and how you think perhaps there's something at the core of that, but then there's so many far-out wild stories about, you know, George Bush being a reptilian and shooting heroin in the Oval Office and all this stuff. That these far-out stories seem to discredit the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I don't know that there are Discordian types out there who maybe have the idea, okay, well, you know, mainstream media has just locked us into propaganda, so we're just going to gum up the works. We're going to do this culture jamming.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I'm having with it, if that's related to what's going on here, I certainly run into a lot of that, whether or not that's related to the Duncan stuff, is that it seems to me that people who are really trying to get beneath the surface of what the mainstream media does become, especially when they first start trying to research things like this and just determine for themselves, they run into the garbage and the hoax and the tongue-in-cheek and the exaggerated before they are able to sort of parse through the real and very damning information. If you just take 9/11, for example,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just the Bush business relationships with the Bin Ladens and Jim Baker's business relationship and Carlyle and all of that stuff, I mean, it's maybe it's not a smoking gun, but it's really damning. You don't have to get into controlled demolition. You don't have to get into the specifics of a 2,000-year-old conspiracy to begin to get a real sense that you know, something is really, really wrong with the mainstream story of 9/11. But it is so contaminated now,
yeah,
that it's very frustrating to me. I don't know. Maybe some of the people contaminating it really believe what they're putting out, but I think a lot of the people contaminating it are either being paid to do it or just enjoy doing it. There's another culture on the internet I'm starting to think is actually pretty prevalent, more than I thought, which is people who like to role play that they're at the center of a conspiracy, and they'll take their role play on unsuspecting discussion boards and forums.
Yeah.
And I think I'm running into some of that as well. So that gums up the works, and I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure what they're up to or why. But so it makes it very confusing for people. And maybe it's possible that the Duncan, you know, I've been calling it alternate reality game, though I definitely, even my own theories stretch the use of that term for sure, is another way to draw some attention to how we're manipulated on the Internet, how real stories get lost on the Internet, and also the mainstream media. If you replace, let's say, Kate Coe over at the LA Weekly with, say, Judith Miller at the New York Times, and you replace Teresa Duncan's death with weapons of mass destruction, it's not a whole lot different. And in that way, it sort of subverts, or even, if I can be a little, you know, maybe even deconstructs in a certain kind of way, the way media propagates information that keeps us basically in the dark or distracted. At the very least, I'm learning a lot about how that works. Even if that wasn't the intention, even if the mainstream story about Duncan is true, if you dig into the types of people she's always mentioning on her blogs, the types of theorists, media theorists, postmodern sorts of folks who sometimes I think are overly intellectualizing, but some things they have it quite right. She was really into Baudrillard, for example, and the idea of we're not seeing reality, we're seeing it mediated through other means, and by the time it gets to us, it's so controlled that, you know, we can't see sort of, I guess the way to say it would be through the looking glass, because that was an analogy he certainly used.
Yeah.
Even some sly jokes referring to him have shown up in the mainstream media reports, which I found kind of interesting, almost tongue-in-cheek. It seemed to be a Baudrillard reference in the New York Magazine reference to a story about Duncan's death. That he talked about how Alice in Wonderland, there's a scene where she's looking through the looking glass, and it looks to be a reflection of what she sees in her own reality, but she said, if I could just peek around the corner, I could see if there's a fire going, and then I would know if it's the same. And there's a quote that's very similar to that, describing a picture in Duncan's blog, where the writer of that New York Magazine article is saying, well, I wonder if there's a fire going, you know, and it's just very similar to that quote. Mm-hmm. And you just got to wonder, are they in on it or not? In any event, basically, it's fairly complex, but it does draw attention to the layers of reality that we try to get through, which is there's a mainstream story, which is more or less useless a lot of times, and then you peel away layers and layers and layers of disinformation, and sometimes underneath you can find out what's going on, and sometimes, like I think I'm going to find by the time I finish your book, you never really know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a lot of times we never really know the truth.
Hey, I got a couple questions for you. Do you think there's a possibility that Teresa Duncan or whoever she was, you know, basically using this hoax to expose some dangerous practices and people, you know, involved in this MK Ultra child abuse, and then the best way basically to remove herself or to hide herself after exposing them was to hoax the suicides?
Well, I will tell you that she did not expose much. She's mm-hmm. got, the one article on County was more hints and hearsay.
But well, maybe there's maybe we need to look deeper into those hints and hearsay. Maybe there's more there too.
Well, I agree, but I think it goes further. If you read her blog correctly, there are so many almost coded references, and we've got about 8 minutes, and there's no way to talk about this without sounding completely paranoid. So, first of all, let me say to your listeners, I'm aware I could be wrong, okay? So, and voices do not talk to me yet through my speakers, you know. So, but one of the things that seems to me going on is there's this sort of whole surface of, oh, look how at all this wonderful glamour. She writes a lot about fashion. She writes about perfume, as I mentioned. She writes about movie stars and models, particularly Kate Moss. She's just, you know, like at least one post a week about Kate Moss. That's the surface. Oh, isn't this glamorous? Isn't this mm-hmm. wonderful? Underneath, she completely is subverting that idea. First of all, she says she's a leftist by background. She claims to have these sort of feminist values, and yet if you read her blogs, entries where they do involve, you know, stories about people exploiting underage people sexually, it's all done sort of tongue-in-cheek. There's a whole other thread of this where she is, she's got a, they both had a friend who, a guy named Blake Robin, who performs as Baron Von Luxury. As he's a DJ, and also he's got a band, and his whole most recent album was dedicated to Sable Starr, who you can't find that much about her, but she was allegedly one of the groupies in the 70s, early 70s, that, you know, in Los Angeles. And these girls were like 13 or 14 years old, and you know, all the rock stars knew they could come and use them sexually. And then her movie, I think, is really, really interesting because she's got this animated video supposedly made in 1999. First of all, there's all kinds of foreshadowing. The main character is blonde and wears the little pigtails. She's a singer, not an artist. She gets disillusioned with the glamorous life. She actually equates glamour with its etymological roots having to do with magic. And Teresa Duncan wrote a lot about the occult. That's what a lot of people don't realize, is very regularly she was putting stuff on about Crowley, about the occult scene, Kenneth Anger. She was very familiar with a lot of that. But anyway, this artist in the video, one of the things she does is participates in a fashion show for a line of fashion based on death. And the name of the fashion show is Play Dead. And in that show, she participates by lying in an open coffin, and evidently Teresa Duncan's funeral was an open coffin funeral. So their magazine titles go by that have titles like, Is There Life After Death? Another magazine title goes, 40 pills that will rock your world. And the title of that article is Eat Me. And it has a picture of a red pill, you know, the sort of red pill, blue pill idea.
Mm-hmm.
The magazine cost $40. She was $40. She was 40 when she, you know, committed suicide, allegedly. So it looks like foreshadowing. But the reason I brought that up is there was another part of that video that I hadn't really talked about that much, which is after she does the death act, she escapes New York, goes back to her hometown. And her agent says, oh, well, don't worry, I've got other stars. And he starts talking about this one. He says, oh, you'd love this kid. And it's a 12-year-old kid who his description includes riding a bike. So he talks about this 12-year-old kid who rides a bike, and it really put me in mind of Johnny Gosch, who was riding his bike on his bike route when he was kidnapped at age 12. And he says, oh, yeah, well, I know he's young, but he's still too old for the limelight. And it's just kind of a throwaway line, and you're not really sure what that's supposed to be about. But there's all these kinds of through lines that make it look like it's almost a coded sort of literary project trying to get at this child trafficking and exploitation,
mm-hmm.
which I think I'm of the belief is actually fairly prevalent and fairly ingrained within our elite power structure. I think it keeps some of our elites in line. I think it funds some things, just like we could we can be fairly sure the CIA was involved in the drug trade. So I think it's pointing to that. Whether it's using that material cynically to tell a story in a new way, to make a game, whether it was subconscious on her part and all this foreshadowing, and there's a bunch more we don't have time to get into where she really seemed to prefigure her own death and the time of her death, you know, I can't say for sure. But that's what I came away with, it gets almost spooky in places.
Do you find it interesting how this movie, and it's called The History of Glamour, right?
Uh-huh.
How it's been released or distributed, who's making it available?
Well, what's fascinating about that, it comes from the Alterati, which is a conjunction with the Grey Lodge website. And Grey Lodge is run, at least in part, by Joseph Matheny, who's very, very much associated with alternate reality games, including, although he denies any of them were alternate reality games, including one called El Centro that revolved around mind control themes. And the plot line to El Centro, of course, was that Project Monarch victims are programmed with suicide programming. If you say a particular word, it invokes that programming and they'll commit suicide. And the plot line is someone wants to invoke that word on many, many Monarch victims and have them all commit suicide. So for Duncan to be talking about Monarch and then to commit suicide, that drew my attention. People on the Alterati blog, people who are involved in, like Dave Saborsky, who are involved in creating alternate reality games, really were not happy with what I was writing and sort of attacked me in their blog articles. And then lo and behold, where does her film surface? But the Grey Lodge website, that is where you can download a copy of The History of Glamour, which, despite the fact that I'm not happy with the way they characterize me, I urge everyone to do. Watch it for yourself. I don't have the link right in front of me, but if you go to the Grey Lodge, I guess, I don't know if it's .com or .org, you should be able to find a copy of it there and download it and watch it for yourself.
Curiouser and curiouser. Hey, one final question before we wrap up. How did Teresa Duncan make up herself, and who is she really?
I don't know. I talked to Carrie Lauren that she allegedly worked with in when she lived in Detroit when she was younger. He's the owner of a bookstore there. He wouldn't talk to me. All he said was, you need to look into the murder angle, basically. And there was no local press in Detroit about it. I talked to the Detroit papers. So I got nothing as far as her Detroit days go. After that, there's dribs and drabs on the internet, but it's contradictory. Did she have movie deals? Did she not? The movie deals she did have, there are different names given. There's not a lot of information out there, to be honest. And none of her people who liked her will talk. The only people that really get interviewed much are people who didn't like her anymore and, you know, were saying bad things about her. So I don't know. I think that at one point I was so uncertain about this, I didn't even know for sure she existed. And I did a whole blog post questioning whether or not she herself actually existed. I think there's enough of a trail that somebody named Teresa Duncan was occupying that space, but I think that there's a character of Teresa Duncan that's who we know. And so I wish I could answer your question.
Yeah.
If I had a budget, or if I worked for a real newspaper and they sent me to, you know, a couple places, I might be able to do a better job. And I'm trying to do a better job with that. But right now, I can't say much about who she was.
On that mysterious note, we're going to wrap it up for today. Ty, thanks for coming on. Why don't you once again mention or give the URL of your website?
It is dreamsendweb, all one word, .com. And you can, if you're tuning in to hear about the Teresa Duncan stuff, there's a Teresa Duncan category on the right. You can click on that and try to slog through it. It's not easy. Like all good blogs, it goes in reverse order, so keep scrolling down and get to the first story.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks for coming on. It's been a fascinating hour.
I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, folks, that wraps up another startling episode of Untamed Dimensions. Join us here each and every week, my friends, for the continuing adventures of the Starship Psychopath. So good night. God bless. Keep those cards and letters coming, all of you out there. In the great American heartland, to the pyramidal structures on Mars. Until that time, Maxwell, until that time.
Presentation, darling.